Mike Dunn, a veteran technologist in the media industry, recently attended and spoke at the 2009 Semantic Technology Conference. In this episode of Interviews with Innovators, he and host John Udell review the highlights of the conference and discuss some of the emerging practical uses of semantic tools and technology from IT Conversations.
So Semtech is, I think, relevant right now. It's an area of early stage focus for me, especially as it relates to emerging media trends, which is a big part of my job. The publisher panel that I was on out there, it just was put up on Vimeo. So that was along with someone from Tribune, New York Times, Huffington Post, CBS Interactive, and then myself. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Tom's keynote, which I think was a very good one. Evan from New York Times wrapped it up and did a pretty good one at the end as well. But, I mean, overall, just sort of looking at this from a CTO's perspective and a media, emerging media, you know, technologist perspective, so someone working in the media industry and then focusing on where should media technologists be focusing on now as it relates to what, you know, this pending change that will be going on, I think it's interesting to me.
Well, it's interesting to me, too. So since I think most people who will be listening to this won't actually go and watch all those videos, and since I just discovered that you can't actually download the audio and listen to them away from your computer, which kind of ticks me off because that's what I'd really prefer to do. I really don't have eight hours to sit in front of my computer and watch all these guys talk. I'd rather be off riding my bicycle and listening to them. But in any event, I did catch Tom's talk, and I had been in touch with him a couple of years before, actually, when he was first shopping around what's now become the OpenCalais stuff out of Reuters. What I saw about a year and a half ago was a toolkit that was about, I would say, entity extraction.
Yes.
As you said, he gave a really interesting talk because OpenCalais is this infrastructure now through which a lot of this early experimentation is flowing. So he seems to have a very interesting perspective on, you know, what kinds of things people are trying to do, what's working and what's not working. Although I'll mention it in an introductory write-up. We're talking about Tom Tague, who's with OpenCalais. And what was actually very refreshing about his talk was he said up front, look, I'm not going to say a word about linked data, OWL, RDF, any of that, right? You know, we've heard plenty about that. You know, this is about, you know, how can you make money with this stuff? Because it's time to actually start building businesses around these ideas that we've been hearing about for such a long time. And, you know, number one on his list, which I thought was pretty interesting, was tools. And he said, who made money in the gold rush? Was it the miners? No, it was hardware stores. It was Levi Strauss, right? It was the people that, you know, sold stuff to the miners. And so, you know, his point number one was there is actually now a market for people who are going to build production-ready tools that enable other folks to work with this stuff, whatever we want to call it. He also was pretty clear, actually, about the fact that if you're somebody who's really passionate about the underlying formats and protocols and standards and mechanisms and theories, then, you know, you should be a tool vendor. You know, and you should not be trying to build, you know, something that is trying to create a user experience for a lot of people.
So the venture side of the panel I did with the other VCs that were out there, I mean, that was one of the things I talked about and a number of them talked about is what are the challenges of, you know, semantic technology-based companies, and semantic technology itself is nascent and complex. And right now, there's a lot of effort and cycles that are wasted on it. Well, wasted is the wrong word because it's dealing with lexicon issues and it's dealing with, you know, theoretical and research-based focus. And those are all fine things to focus on. But if that becomes your emphasis, so you're not going to resonate with people that are trying to make businesses out of these things. Yeah. You know, that needs to sort of stay off in the back end of how these things work. And right now, looking at, you know, what are you trying to do and how are you going to do it and how is it going to add value to a business if you're a componentized service, or how are you as a business going to, you know, add something to a user that doesn't care what, you know, is running this and doesn't care what's behind it and what's defined it.
Yeah. So the things that he was kind of bullish on was first tools, then advertising. And I know that you're involved in that as well.
Yep.
And generally he saw some specific kinds of opportunities in some areas of publishing, but not in others. The things that he was kind of down on, interestingly, I thought, were one, what do you call it, the frosting on top of social, which is nobody knows how they're going to make money in social networking in the first place. And so to think that a semantic layer is going to solve that is, well, there's no evidence for it. Also, the idea of semantic search, you know, the idea that a more precise kind of search capability, a more accurate kind of search capability, which is one of the things that we all have long imagined will emerge from linked data substrates, is ultimately a bit of a red herring as well. I thought those were all really good points, but you mentioned your own tools that you're working on, and I know that you're active in the area of advertising and specifically search engine optimization as it can be enabled in a practical way by, you know, something that we would call semantic substrate. So talk about what you're doing there to the extent that it, you know, that you can. And
so Hearst has, you know, a lot of my role is broad-based technology role. It's more of an enterprise CTO focus, along with some of the, you know, venture technology work I do. But it's working with a lot of our divisions, and our newspaper division has a huge effort underway that involves leveraging a semantic technology-based toolkit. But the end goal is really to do smart things from a business perspective. So they procured a CMS that has some semantic technology components associated with it. One is a text mining capability, and one is a digital asset management capability that both through workflow feed into a CMS that's then able to produce the web properties that we have in our businesses. It's a company out of Montreal called Enstein. And, you know, the use of semantic technologies to do the text mining side of this is critical, and it actually allows for the workflow to occur. But the end state is to do a better job of publishing the content, making available the content, and having it out of the box just be very rich from an SEO perspective, and being able to leverage that in a single platform, so a single, you know, production platform that we can have every one of our papers leveraging this. And the beauty of that is, first of all, each individual property is going to, you know, their cost to produce goes down because you're leveraging a broad-based platform. And then if something is successful in one region or one brand or one, you know, campaign that you do, then you can take that learning and use it in all of the other properties. And so you're able to accelerate things that do good things for you from a, you know, a business perspective, and you can, you know, decelerate or even end of life things that just don't add any value and aren't desired by the audience that you're trying to satisfy.
When you say semantic text mining, that sounds like what you mean is there's automated technology to read through stuff and parse out entities and bucket them according maybe to some ontology or taxonomy that is defined across all of the different properties. Is that roughly what's happening?
So it's text content, it's any other media, associated media, whether it's you know, photograph, video, whatever, the whole package that goes into telling a story through one of these properties, and making sure that by the, you know, if you take a story as concept to production, the text mining aspect of it, which leverages, you know, contextual-based linguistic approach to natural language processing, ends up producing a semantic entity that is properly categorized, is properly ready to be ingested into the workflow that ends up producing the content as it hits that published environment.
So that part's automated, right? There's not human involvement, but is part of it also, like we were talking about in the case of OpenCalais, you know, because the other part of this is that you kind of need human attention to, you know, the categorization and the analysis of a lot of stuff to, you know, first of all, you know, get through the opaque media like audio and video, but second of all, to get the text stuff right as well.
There's a high degree of automation, but as with anything, automation will get you some strange results. So actually one of the semantic tools that Tom talked about, and you know, I've met with them numerous times, we're doing some work with them, is Zamanta, and that's a browser-based plugin that leverages semantic technologies to produce its end result. But what it's doing is it's in an automated fashion, it's producing for a writer of a story, so whether it's a blogger or a journalist for a newspaper or whatever it is, wherever this tool is leveraged, it's producing recommendations for things that you could link, things that make sense to link to within your story, providing you access to those links in a push button sort of format, tags, so appropriate tags against the context of the story, associated rich media, whether it's photos or videos, and then related articles or related posts that have a similarity and would make sense for a reader to want to continue the story. So it could be in your own domain, or it could be in the web at large, depending on how you implement.
It's looking at what's in your browser and saying, oh, this could be related, that could be related. Where is it finding those things that it thinks could be related?
So the ingestion of the sources, if it's on the public side, that's a pre-existing environment. If you're doing it, so it's more server side, it's something you instantiate within your server environment, okay, then you're implementing your OPML. It's categorizing that, adding, it's labeling from a contextual standpoint, and then you're able to draw upon that. But there has to be a human interface side, because you as an author, or me as an author, or anybody, we're going to take a look at what did we really intend to write, and does it make sense to associate that article? So you get to go in and pick and choose.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And for us, for our traditional journalists who are sort of new to digital media, it's actually a brilliant primer as to the things you want to do that make your content from a digital media perspective more valuable, whether it's, tagging, linking, related links and the associated media that in the past, somebody else did.
Yeah.
But in the digital media world, you want to have this tool to be able to do it. We actually find Zemanta is really useful as a first step, and it blends really nicely with the deeper automation that will occur within Einstein. But in Einstein, there's human interaction as well. I mean, you do have to have knowledgeable people that are looking at what's being produced and deciding, how to push things through the value chain that ends up producing that content.
And what kind of automation are you able or not able to bring to the domain of opaque, audio and video kinds of stuff? Stuff that can't necessarily be automatically read and analyzed the way text can.
I think both, there are tools that are doing audio. They've been around podcasting. They've been doing it for a number of years. There's a company up in Connecticut. I just can't remember their name right now, but they've been doing, voice to text categorization for a while. And on video, there's been tools around for quite a while. I'm not seeing these tools integrate those yet, but they all are web services.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be that would be a straightforward project, because those services exist, to integrate those and allow for the deeper context of what's occurring. So for example, you're going to produce a podcast out of this, and there's going to be a lot of contextual based information that you'd want to be able to extract. Some people do it into a blog post around it, so it's here's the audio, here's the summary of what's within that.
Mm-hmm.
You should want to be able to fully data enable that, label that, so that we talked about Einstein. Well, there should be a pointer to a URI to a URL to be able to immediately have that be available as one of the things that gets linked in the post that surrounds this.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's in fact, not going to happen, because I don't have a tool that'll pull those entities out, and I tend to not have the time to go through and sort it all out, right? It's enough to just kind of edit the thing and get on with everything else I'm doing. So, that's a kind of a nice example of
it'd be great to have a community be able to do that, to be able to have interest in this, listen to it, and then, based on tools that they have available, or just a mundane process, be able to go in and do that work. That's, that's sort of curating, right?
It absolutely is. I actually have thought about that and have even imagined, because one of the huge enablers there would be that it's that kind of thing that I wouldn't want to do at my computer, which is, you know, right. where I'm not going to be when I'm listening to one of these things. I'm going to be out on my bicycle or out running or something like that. And so I've actually, you know, just kind of a tangent here, but I've actually thought a lot about that there need to be in portable listening devices ways of at least kind of marking points of interest, you know, so that you can come back and do the annotation later. And start to make that a more two-way sort of thing, but that's a bit of a tangent.
It isn't, because you and I share that passion for, you know, podcasting while we're listening to podcasts while we're out, you know, doing other things. I do it while I'm, you know, commuting from Connecticut to New York City or driving up to Vermont, you know, all winter long, and I have to drive to Albany usually once a month I'm on the board of a bank up there, so I have a 3-hour drive up and a 3-hour drive back. And I sometimes like carry a portable recording device because I listen to some of these podcasts and I'd want to, you know, retain some thought I had on it, because later I want to go either comment to the author or comment, mm-hmm. you know, in a blog post I write about it. And, you know, it's a really cumbersome process when to make podcasting or just the way media is produced today really two-way. You have to have that way to interact with it immediately when you're dealing with it.
And yes.
I am finding tools on the iPhone, you know, apps that are being developed for the iPhone and tools on the iPhone in general to be getting closer to that. So I do think it's we've come a long way in the, you know, 4 years or whatever podcasting's been out there. But, there needs to be something to allow it to occur.
So so in any case, the stuff that we've been discussing here is the sort of thing that helps a media business effectively do more or better with the same number or fewer people, right? In other words, it sort of optimizes their production process, you know. And actually, the example that Tom Tigg gave was of he kind of categorized three layers of publishing, so traditional newspapers and journals, and then in between what he calls a combination of editorial and aggregation, and he gave examples like the Huffington Post, and then the third level being the robotic stuff like, say, Google News. And he saw that in that middle category is where, you know, you've got this combination going on of aggregation and original production, and that it's in that space that by turbocharging the workflow with power tools, you can enable a smaller number of people and a much less expensive operation to produce something which winds up being 80% as compelling as a conventional publication. And so that, you know, that he saw that as a very clear opportunity there. And that sounded really sensible to me. And I'm sure that's, you know, analogous to what's happening on the production side in your world. You and I talked separately about your view of the opportunity here around advertising and search optimization. So you should probably spell out, you know, exactly what you see happening there as well.
Sure. And you know, for us, just to comment on the publishing side real quick as well, because there's the three basic, you know, nodes of this direction are advertising, search, and publishing, and or content in general. Somewhere in the near future, it's happening at different states of velocity for each of them, but they will all be leveraging semantic capabilities if it adds value, which I think all three of them are exploring whether it will or won't. But if there's something you can do for, you know, less infrastructure, for less cost, and you do it in kind, so you're doing it in a single way to do it versus having, you know, 12 different entities, business entities, doing 12 different things, there's just no economy of scale there. Mm-hmm. And so you may end up having the same end result from a published perspective, but you're using a sort of consolidated, repeatable platform to be able to produce that. And that's where, you know, any one of businesses, doesn't have to be a newspaper, it's any business that, you know, is trying to do something at scale. If you can leverage a single platform to do it versus, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen platforms, it's just common sense as you're going to be able to do a better job from a fiscal standpoint and from a workflow standpoint, you know, much more well-defined. So just you know, I moderated a, as part of Internet Week, I moderated a panel that was on semantic advertising. There was a couple of vendors that were on the panel that you know, are going to market as semantic advertising-based companies. And then there were a number of media folks. This was held in New York City. So there were a number of media folks from the media companies out of New York City. New York Times was there, Newsweek was there, myself from Hearst, and I think we had a couple of folks from the ad industry as well. And it was sort of a very early, you know, it was an initial kickoff meeting focused on semantic advertising, and we will have more meetings like this. This all centers around the semantic technology meetup group that's part of it's in New York City that I think is over 1,000 participants right now. I actually can't recall what the number is, but it's fairly large and very active.
And what seems to be the early consensus about what semantic advertising would mean?
Well, today I think it's companies that are using either a linguistics approach or a natural language processing approach to be able to create contextual-based advertising, whether it's display or text-based contextual advertising, that has better margins associated with it, that is more successful from a campaign standpoint because the contextual aspect is just better defined. I don't know that the link, I haven't seen yet, and I haven't talked to a company that's able to do this. The true linking of a data-enabled piece of, you know, content payload associated with a data-enabled piece of advertising payload is fully contextually relevant yet. I haven't seen that, and I know that's the desire of these companies to be able to do that. But today it's just, you know, it's better SEO, it's better context around the ad purchase versus the, you know, the intelligence of the placement. And I know when Tom talked, you know, he really talked about that as where the opportunities are, is the actual placement or the association. And, you know, adding in the aspects of search, you know, making that contextually relevant. So you have a piece of content payload, you have a piece of advertising payload, and now you have a desired viewer of that coming into a search engine and wanting to be able to find it and have it be relevant. You know, that's sort of the holy grail of that, those three nodes.
So we already obviously do link those things today using,
they, you know, yeah, they're just, but just straight contacts. You know, it's just, it's based on an advertising buy and it's based on keyword contextual, either SEM or SEO. And
yeah, but that would be, I mean, well, that is a sort of first level of semantic linking, right? Absolutely. By keyword, you know, is like by tag is, you know, that's a, you know, that's an association between these things. And so, I mean, really, I guess, you know, that this is all kind of a fancy way of saying we're just trying to get smarter about that.
Right? Correct. And, you know, deeper relevance.
Yeah.
And it's going to prove itself out. And every one of these companies will tell you these metrics, but it's going to prove itself out by the printed percentage of improvement you get from a, you know, revenue perspective. An ad campaign ends up being, you know, 5 or 10 or 15% more successful if it goes through one of these engines versus just a traditional buy that's, you know, more rudimentary. Then they will add value. And almost every one of these companies, I do like this approach. You know, they want to be able to prove with their customers that you can add these percentages of margins on top of their, you know, what was just a traditional revenue stream of ad advertising revenue, that they can add, you know, that whatever the percentage points are above that. I think any media company or blog network will try it if they can start to see some of those results.
So what was your sense at the conference of the relationship between the kind of academic and theoretical crowd and the folks who are now showing up saying, okay, where's the money? And, you know, how do we, optimize search and make publishing operations more efficient? I mean, was there did it feel like there was kind of friction there, or you know, was that a welcome change, or what was your sense of how that played out?
So definitely a percentage of people who had been going for years. So I think the conference had grown. You know, I talked to the organizers at a sort of social event they had one evening at the conference, and you know, the conference had grown dramatically year over year, and this year, you know, much more involvement with media people and VC people such as myself being there, with startups being there that are, you know, looking to push their businesses along, both through funding or through finding customers for their wares. There's still, you know, open data research academic sorts that were there, and I think, you know, I think everybody understood that this is a natural migration of the way things go. Mm-hmm. If you go to, like, I go up to the Boston Semantic Technology Meetup. Last time I was there, I met with Tim Berners-Lee when I was up there, getting his perspective on, you know, linked data and media was very interesting. That crowd in Boston was very different than the crowd I see in New York. In New York, it's about, you know, media and business, and, you know, there are folks from the financial industry that are there. There are folks from sort of the data services side of media, such as Reuters, that attend. There's startups like Daylife and Zamanta and Apture and the Adaptive Blue folks that, you know, either present at these meetings or show up at these meetings. Up in Boston, it's still, you know, that's a very academic culture up there and community, and it's still about sort of the breadth of work that they still feel needs to occur from the purist side of semantic technologies. And there's nothing wrong with that. These are just different cultures focusing on different things. But I think definitely in New York and definitely in San Jose at Semtech, it was more about the next stage, which is, you know, how are we going to extend the relevant for business side of what's going on within this focused area.
Yeah, and I guess what'll be interesting there is that then, to the extent that there starts to be some commercial energy, that's going to help drive actually the research agenda, and you know, potentially, everyone will be happier, right? Because you know, otherwise there is a tendency for, I think, it to kind of languish, and certainly, I mean, it's been, you know, a long time coming. And like, yeah, you said, you know, from a purist perspective, you know, there's still a sense that, well, it's not fully baked, you know. So I think that this is probably great timing, actually, to kind of help, you know, bring things together in all respects.
Well, just look at two areas of focus, librarians and linguists, who, you know, this is sort of a goldmine industry for them to be involved in, because their skill set just is a natural fit for working within this industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, they add huge value, and NLP-based, you know, experts, they add huge value. And if you're developing, you know, if you have an initiative, like the New York Times talked about their initiative, and they have, you know, they basically have linguists that are on staff that are have been categorizing their content in their own, you know, in their own structure. It doesn't follow an open structure, but they have stated that they'll be moving to either to produce their data and make it available in an open environment. But they've been doing this since the early 1900s. You know, they always believed it was something important to do, and I think they now just realize that there's a broader, you know, standards community out there that they want to become a part of.
Yeah. And also, well, one of the things I learned from hanging around with some folks at MIT, the Simile Project at MIT, you know, what I really liked about the approach that they'd been taking in recent years was that they kind of came out of the ontology wars and said, let's just not try to take that hill, right? That, you know, trying to get everybody to agree what to name things is maybe counterproductive. And so let's just focus on letting clusters of people name things how they will, and then have ways to make mappings between them, which I thought was refreshingly pragmatic, and I think is absolutely right in terms of moving things forward, because you just committees to decide what to call things are just, I think, ultimately kind of doomed.
Yeah, I would agree. Tim is a good example of somebody who sort of by choice lives in that space just because of his involvement with W3C org, and they push it. It's always good to have standards if they have value and they allow for things to occur in a more rapid fashion. But a lot of times just getting to that standard is, just mind-numbingly slow. And one of the things I've brought up in a couple different of instances talking with companies about semantic technologies is you can't add this to create value, but at the same time you're adding latency to your workflow, whether it's systemic latency or you're from a staff production standpoint, you're adding latency, because that's not the goal. The goal is to do things faster in a more automated fashion and in a more predictable fashion. And today, still, if you talk to someone who's dealing with a semantic tool, there is a ton of latency there that needs to go away. It needs to be, needs to be, the throughput needs to be improved. And it just the basic concept of pushing content out into a, servable based environment. If you're adding more to it just by design, you've added some latency. And so you have to find a way to optimize that. And then the other side of it is just the ability to explain this to lay people, business people, why this is important to do. And that's a challenge any of us that are technologists who are trying to, socialize a technology opportunity to a layer of management and business stakeholders that, are just trying to figure out the right way to be in business. And so you have to have a very straightforward way to prove it out. And it's why something like an Einstein is able to be sold, because you're not focusing on the technology, you're focusing on the end result.
Right. Although I have to say, having hung around publishing for a long time, that I never really got any pushback to the proposition that you needed to describe stuff, with metadata, and that, there was tremendous value that would flow from that. The pushback was always, and justifiably, yeah, but people won't do that. we just can't make people do that, right? Or, to what you said earlier, we can't imagine a way to optimize that process so that it doesn't, in fact, bog things down. And that that is a tough nut to crack, actually. So
Yeah, I agree. Well, you work for some forward-thinking, organizations, so as well, not all organizations are as forward-thinking as InfoWorld and Byte and those entities. So.
Yeah. Well, this is a pretty good ramble about your visit. Like I said, I'm irked that I can't just go listen to that stuff, because I would like to just get about 8 hours of that stuff and put it on my little player. And
this gets into an important aspect of what we hope semantic technologies, and just sort of dealing with the semantic layer per se, where you have a lot of content coming out of a lot of different sources, and you want to push it out to end nodes. And you don't know what node it's going to go to, but you want to be able to repurpose that content in the format that node's going to accept. Mm-hmm. So in this case, you're just asking for something on an MP3 player. The content is there and available, and it should be up to that sort of bus to allow you to say, yeah, that can go there. And, it exists in this layer. We can push it out to that node. And the thought of only pushing things into a browser or only pushing things into a mobile phone needs to stop. Content gets produced and it has a variety of different nodes it could go to, including a data exchange, mm-hmm. where, you may be able to push that into any sort of business model just as a data brokering environment. Mm-hmm. And I do think, for us, every talk I give internally, that's what I talk about. Because I really think we're limiting ourselves when we only say, hey, we're producing a website for this, browser or for these sets of browsers. It's really about an extraction layer so any node can accept it. When the Palm Pre came out, versus the iPhone, those are just two mobile nodes, and there's tons of others. Mm-hmm. And you should have an environment that allows you to do that. And that's what you should aim for. I don't know if they exist, you know, in a purely automated fashion today, but that should be our goal.
Yeah, that and also a sort of recombination capability. I mean, I think a huge opportunity that's still relatively untouched in the online publishing space is that when something becomes topical because of current events, that you can rapidly assemble a package of stuff, you know, from the archive. And, you know, right now it's still, you know, let's just say, I think publishing organizations are not very agile about that process.
Right.
And, you know, it has to do with, you know, their relative inability to effectively query the archive and, you know, reassemble it for current purposes.
So when you have a fully categorized archive of content, you know, that's data enabled, that will make it easier, I think. And and when you have an environment that not only thinks about ways to publish to your emerging nodes, you know, browser, mobile, whatever, but also is publishing out to your traditional nodes for newspapers, you know, publishing out to pull. Mm-hmm. If it's going through that same engine, and in today's world, we're still not there yet.
Yep.
But somewhere down the line, there's huge optimization opportunities to be able to, you know, do custom publishing even out to traditional, you know, whether it's an e-reader or a pulp. If it goes through the same engine, you have the same basic workflow to produce all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that, you know, that used to really frustrate me, to be honest, at organizations like InfoWorld and before that at Byte, because, you know, as much as they've sort of migrated online, they still think like print publications a lot of the time in terms of, you know, there's this issue and then there's the next issue and this is the one that's on the stands right now, and then it kind of, you know, it kind of falls off the continental shelf into the archive.
Yeah.
That's just this kind of great undifferentiated long tail that generates a, you know, trickle of page views. But in fact, there's just all sorts of things out on that long tail that can light up in different configurations as current events warrant. And, you know, that should be a huge opportunity, and it should be a huge value to the reader. You know, why should I have to do the hard work of assembling a context, trawling through the archive in order to satisfy my intellectual curiosity about something that you wrote about today, when I know that you've got stuff going back that's relevant? You know, why make why make me do that work?
Yeah, one of our properties that does a really good job of this is Popular Mechanics. They have embraced the web for years, and they, you know, they have their normal monthly publication, but they leverage the web. You know, every day they leverage it. They think of it as part of their publishing model, and they extend their content, they repurpose their content, and that print publication is, you know, it's still the largest part of their revenue. But their online revenue keeps growing and growing from a, you know, percentage against whole.
Yeah.
And they just see it as, you know, we are publishing to a variety of different nodes, and I've, you know, they embrace that end node, you know, potential when Popular Mechanics just exists as a brand that's producing very rich content, no matter what node you're ingesting it on, whether it's audio, video, mm-hmm. on a phone, you know, through a browser or through the print publication. They're, you know, it's still all about their content being able to be interacted with in whatever way the customer, quote unquote, whatever, audience, customer, whatever, reader, desires, and they're just producing that. Yeah.
There's also a piece of this that's about the editorial process itself, which is just worth mentioning now that I'm off on this particular tangent. But, you know, I mean, in editorial planning, right, there's always this process of, you know, sometimes implicitly, but often explicitly saying, all right, well, you know, what's the story that we've told so far, right, in previous installments of this topic, and, you know, how does what we're doing now advance that story, right? How does it extend what we've done before? And your ability to do a good job of that is a function of your ability to have a strong command of what you actually did before, right? To be able to sort of marshal that prior context to inform your current planning. And that often is quite a haphazard kind of thing. It's like somebody remembers, oh yeah, we did this and that, but you know, they don't actually have the data at their fingertips to fully inform that planning. And so that's just another sort of, another piece of it that makes that can make the stuff going forward a lot more interesting and valuable.
I totally agree. And so on our side, if we're looking at the toolkit that allows the editors of, the emerging editors, those that really think about being creators of the whole story, if it allows them to do that job in an easier fashion, then, we embrace those tools. Those are tools we're always looking at. I went out and spoke at Dan Gilmore's Knight Foundation to his classes out at ASU last spring. And those kids that are going through that program totally embrace the fact that they're just broad-based creators now. They're getting a journalistic education from one of the, greatest new media journalists around, and he is really teaching them to own the whole story. They may not be breaking the story, but they're going to flesh it out and add all the contextual relevance of telling that story around it, and they'll do it through any number of different mechanisms, whether it's writing the text, producing the video, or producing sort of the whole multimedia, approach to it, that's what they're going to be doing. And so from our standpoint, we want to provide tools for that. And these kids get that. Like I went down a list of, 6 or 8 good tools that I recommend to our journalists who are already working in the field. And, some of them are already using, half of them, because they're kids and they're just soaking this stuff up. But the others, they're like, they're already out there using it. They're using social tools. They're using filtering tools. They're using, traditional RSS-based aggregation tools. And that's the journalist of the future needs to be able to do that.
God, we must be old guys to be talking about traditional RSS-based stuff.
Yeah, well, what's that?
This is actually very cool. We managed to have a whole conversation about semantic stuff without actually going too far down into the weeds.
Yeah, I agree. One of my favorite quotes, it's in the video on the venture panel when it comes out, but one of the VCs sitting next to me, started doing, RDFL type, acronym dropping. And here he is, a traditional VC, and he basically, was just making a joke out of it, but it was hilarious. So, because VCs certainly don't want to hear all that stuff. They want to see where the value is. So.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mike. This was fun and informative.
Good deal.
Have a good day. See ya.
You've been listening to Interviews with Innovators with host John Udell.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Udell. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great edition of Interviews with Innovators on IT Conversations.